This paramedic just, her uncle just happened to be the longtime sound man for Sarah Jessica Parker. And so I guess he kind of brought the idea of the film and the trailer to her. And once she kind of heard the story about this paramedic and saw a bit about the film and whatnot, she was compelled and offered to narrate for the film. And so she did, you know, sat for a whole narration sequence. And, you know, when I heard that, it really struck a chord in me, because to know that someone who is that, you know, that busy and that famous and that prominent was willing to lend her voice to a project like this, it was powerful. And I think for anyone who was involved in the production or anyone who watches it, you know, and hears someone like that doing the narration, I think that's it was just jaw-dropping.
Thank you for tuning in to the Critical Conversations podcast, brought to you by Mind the Frontline. Established in 2023 as a 501c3, Mind the Frontline is your ally in the journey to support those who selflessly safeguard our communities. Their core mission revolves around pioneering innovation in research, education, and overall well-being, specifically tailored to healthcare, military, and public service frontline first responders. The Critical Conversation podcast is a dedicated space for police, fire, EMS, allied health workers, dispatchers, air medical, and military personnel, along with their families. Here, we dive into the heart of the matter, tackling essential topics such as mental health strategies, recovery methods, treatment options, the latest research, and professional development opportunities. Before we dive into today's episode on Critical Conversations, we do want to, however, acknowledge the nature of our discussions. Some of the content discussed may be triggering or intense as we explore the challenges and the triumphs within the first responder community. We recognize that these discussions may evoke strong emotions or memories. If you or someone you know is struggling and needs immediate support, we urge you to reach out to your agency's mental health resources or your local peer support group. In time of mental health crisis, you can always contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline by phone or via text at 988. Please remember, you are never alone and help is always available. At Mind the Frontline, we are more than just a podcast. We are a community committed to fostering resilience within the entire first responder family. So whether you're on the front lines or supporting those who are, we invite you to subscribe, engage, and be a part of this vital mission. To learn more, please visit us at www.mindthefrontline.org. Now let's dive into today's Critical Conversation. Welcome back to Critical Conversations by Mind the Front Lines, the podcast for first responders, listeners, and members of the Mind the Front Line community. On today's episode, we will be discussing the photography of first responders from the front lines. Our guest speaker for this episode is Derek Hanley. He's a longtime paramedic. He's also a disabled veteran combat medic. He's a published author and a published photographer, and he's also the CEO and creative director of DOPE. Derek brings a wealth of knowledge and experience to our ongoing mission of fostering resilience within the first responder community and being transparent and just having those raw conversations. Let's jump into today's episode and learn some valuable insights from our honorable but not broken guest. Welcome, Derek. How you doing, brother?
Chris, thank you so much for having me, man. It's an honor to be here.
Absolutely. You know, kind of tell us a little bit about yourself. I want to kind of hear your story. I know we've kind of talked about it in the pre-show and just in the conversations leading up to this episode, but, you know, tell us, our viewers and our listeners, you know, kind of what is your story? You know, we've learned that you're a published author, you know, you've done photography, you were a combat medic, but, you know, let's hear it from you.
Yeah, right on. So joined the Air Force in 2000, right out of high school. You know, before that time, I'd gotten my EMT while I was in high school and was a kind of volunteer responder and was in the Firefighter Explorer program. And, you know, I think that being part of the fire department, being part of the ambulance company kind of gave me a sense of, you know, brotherhood, camaraderie, that kind of home away from home aspect that I think I was kind of looking for at that time in my life. And got in the military, became a medic with the Air Force and was stationed at the Air Force Level 1 Trauma Center down in San Antonio. Back in the day, it was Wolford Hall Medical Center, and it was a flagship of the Air Force medical program. I mean, I kind of grumbled when I got that assignment, because when I joined the Air Force, you know, I wanted to see Germany and Japan and all those exciting overseas bases and stuff, but I ended up getting shipped down to Lackland, where you do your basic training and whatnot, and So I grumbled a bit, but then realized it was really a singular opportunity as a paramedic to be at the top of the food chain when it comes to being, you know, in the military and being part of their medical corps. And so did that for a while. Had some insane experiences, but great stuff because we were able to work with the Air Force trauma surgeons and that type of a thing. And then did my 4 years active duty, got out, worked as a civilian paramedic for a couple years. And then I'll be honest, Chris, I got burnt out from being in the field. You know, I was volunteering. I was working, you know, 12-hour shifts multiple times and just kind of got sick of it and ended up working trade work, you know, carpentry and plumbing and heating, and kind of got out of patient care for a while, and then joined the Army, became a combat medic with them, did that for 4 years up in upstate New York with the 42nd Infantry Division. Did that and then moved to California in 2012 to help a friend start a photography and video production business. Worked that with him for a couple years, sold that off, and then started my own thing doing photo video work. And then fast forward to 2020, January 2020, I got a behind-the-scenes research position with Alameda County EMS and was just trying to get back out into the field to see what it was like to work there, because I worked in Texas and New York and, you know, wanted to see what the Bay Area was like. Went out with them and then had the flash of, hey, you have this technical knowledge of how to be a photographer and produce videos and stuff. Why don't you try and bring those two worlds together and see what you can capture out there in the field? So it was out capturing imagery just to basically give back to the medics, because most people don't know what a paramedic does on a daily basis. And so they could show their family and say, hey, look what daddy does at work. And so started off innocently enough, and then, you know, boom, March 2020 hit, pandemic struck, lockdown in the Bay Area. And, you know, I could have just kind of hung back because it was a work from home position essentially at that point for me. But I really felt compelled to go back out into the field with my camera to capture this amazing work that these providers were doing, and just the bravery and heroism that these folks had to show every single day when they showed up to work. You know, it was the least I could do to it was a risk, but to go back out there, capture these stories and show the world, because, you know, other than soldiers in combat, you know, I don't really know who's demonstrated more service before self than these medics who were out there during this period of extended crisis.
Man, that's quite the journey you've been on, you know, from EMS, from military service to, you know, running and owning your own photography business. And I think, at least for me, I can be extremely thankful, because there are some that are local that have captured me and provided me with some of those copies. They do it out of the passion, just like we do the passion of care. I think you completely relate to that. But, you know, for someone like us on the other side who, you know, we don't know how we look, you know, while we're on scene, we never see that. But I can tell you the pictures that I have gotten from those photographers, they're still near and dear to my heart, you know, and it's awesome to kind of be able to look back and go, man, yeah, you know, I did that, or I was doing that, depending on what service and where you are in your professional career. But man, thank you very much for your service, and thank you for what you do and highlighting that. You know, I can't think of a higher level than, you know, being in the middle of the pandemic and going out and showcasing these first responders who show up day in and day out, exhausted, putting the service of others before them. You know, when you look at a lot of motivation behind first responder photography in general, you know, at least the stuff that I've learned, and I definitely want to hear your perspective after this, but, you know, you look at these photographers and they're definitely driven by like a deep sense of duty and compassion towards their colleagues. You know, you used to be a former paramedic, you used to be of service, and now you're kind of on the other side of that lens, so to speak, taking a look and kind of highlighting these individuals that are doing these. I do know that, like, when you look at the research conducted by the National Institute of Mental Health, you know, it does suggest that individuals who pursue photography as kind of being more of a self-expression, and it definitely enhances like the more of the emotional well-being and resilience. Do you think like that was kind of a part of the drawing and the calling as well?
On some level, I'm sure it was. I mean, you know, as an artist, as a creative, you have this almost like a burning desire to want to bring something into the world. And, you know, as when you create something, you can, you know, use your powers to help a company make more money, or you can use your powers to help promote a cause. You know, there's lots of different ways that you can use your art, you know, when you create something. But with this project, you know, Photos from the Front Lines, it was really to give visibility, I think, to these folks and what they have to do and what they have to see, the emotional state that they're in when they're in these circumstances. You know, I think all this stuff is important to give visibility because, you know, you tell someone you're a paramedic and, you know, the association is that you're an ambulance driver. Not knowing.
I was just going to say that.
The years of training that it takes, the internships, all the skills you have to learn, on top of the fact that, you know, you're rendering all your medicine in the field by yourself in the back of a moving vehicle. Now, I've worked in, you know, I've been a part of the trauma team, you know, inside that emergency department, and that's a whole different ballgame. I mean, you have layers and layers of backup and protection, and you have good lighting and, you know, all this stuff that you don't have as a field medic. And so, you know, you kind of mentioned it. You could talk to somebody about this till you're blue in the face. You know, I could tell you stories and this and that. But when you see something, it hits you here. You know, it hits you in the heart. And that's where I think, you know, a lot of these stories need to go, is because, you know, you can spout statistics and you can show infographics, stuff like that. But when you see a person in these situations, I think that's what really kind of puts the hook in people and it goes, wow, like, now I understand. And things like photography and film have that effect. And that's why they were used back in World War II as an important tool for recruiting and for getting the public on board with all these big changes that were going to happen throughout the country in order to be able to mount a defense against, you know, the powers that be during that time. So that's why, you know, they had the, you know, no one cares about World War I because there were no photographers, there were no video cameras at the front lines. But once they started pushing, you know, photographers and even Hollywood film directors around the front lines capturing this stuff and sending it back, that's when people, you know, that's when their jaws dropped and they went like, wow, this is what these folks are seeing over there. Like, man, we should thank them for their service. We should take care of their health care and their education, make sure they can buy a home. And that's where all these programs came about to take care of veterans, because people go, man, they have to see a lot of trauma. Like, that's rough stuff. I'm glad I didn't have to. Just let me do what I can to take care of them when they get back from serving us. And so that's, you know, that's my book's in black and white because I'm kind of hearkening back to those days of combat photography and showing people, hey, look at what these folks are doing, man. We should be taking care of these folks a lot more than we are. Because a lot of times folks are just discarded in you, when you work in EMS, you know, you can average rate for, you know, burnout and as a paramedic is what, 5 years or so. And
5 to 7 on average.
So, you know, you talk about, you know, you serve 4 years in the military, and you get thanked for your service, you get all these benefits and this and that. And, you know, there's lots of positions in the military where you work, where you don't see combat at all. You don't see any trauma at all. You could work at, you know, behind a desk for 4 years. And, you know, compare that with the traumatic exposures of any paramedic who's been on the streets for more than 6 months. And there is no comparison. And so there's a huge disconnect in society in how we take care of those who sacrifice for us. And that's what my book is hopefully trying to do, is kind of tie those two professions together in people's minds of military and medic, because there's an equivalent level of traumatic exposures as well as things like back injuries and, you know, all these other physical ailments that can come about from doing this job, even for a short time. And so, you know, with the increased visibility, hopefully that can lead to increased, you know, understanding and awareness of the public, which then leads to empathy, which then hopefully we'll see some results and some more honor for medics, because that's what I think is the really missing ingredient in society relating to medics, is just honor. Because if you honor something, you want to take care of it, you want to see it do well, you want to make sure that it has a long and healthy, happy life.
And you said so many good points there, and I like that, you know, the honor part. I do think when you compare yourself, you know, like World War II, they came back, they showed the general public about what was happening on the front lines and the trauma and some of the gruesome injuries that our soldiers were experiencing and what they had to go through and the stressors and not having enough supplies or equipment to do the job and the resources, not having the bright white lights, not having the additional backup, you know. And so out of that, you know, you had things like the GI Bill, VA assistance, all these things that came out that were good because the general public and society came together and said, hey, you're right. What can I do? I didn't go over there and serve, but I want to serve you and thank you for your service. But when you look at, you know, and I feel like fire, you know, fire, police officers, they get a little bit more of a reputation and they get a little bit more honor, I think, than EMS. I feel like EMS and, you know, dispatchers can go the same route here. Kind of just behind the scenes, the redheaded stepchild, you know, we're kind of everybody looks at us as like, oh, like all you do is just pick me up from my house and take me to the hospital. Like, because that's where EMS started, right? It started where basically the hospitals needed to get them there. So that's why 911 got created. And then it was just like, they would just pick them up and just drive them straight there. And so I think the older generation had that kind of idea because they had seen that. But really, you know, EMS is completely evolved itself to the point where, you know, we're coming to your house, we're creating and initiating therapies that they would in the ER. We have a higher level of training. We don't get paid very well. We don't have great benefits, you know, depending on if you're working for private versus government, and even that could differ. And they're not getting that level of respect, you know? And so like when things like ambulance driver came out and the nurse's stethoscope and things like that, just a couple years ago, you know, I had to just laugh a little bit because that's exactly how I felt. You know, I felt very undervalued and very unappreciative. And it's not by any fault of the general public. They're not educated to what the EMS provider does in their level of education and really what they do and see on a day-to-day basis. Like, man, I went out on a back injury for almost 2 years. You know, that took a huge, you know, financial toll on my family, not to mention an emotional and psychological toll and physical toll on my body. And not to compound that, but think about someone, I've been in public safety for 23 years. I have seen almost daily trauma. You know, it's like being on the front lines for 23 years without a break sometimes, you know, and we're working these hard, you know, these medics and EMTs, you know, nurses, dispatchers, we're working everybody harder because the system is just tapped. And, you know, having those pictures that you're doing and you're collecting, like pictures say 1,000 words. They say more than a paragraph or a blog or a news article could ever say, because what we show through that picture is the human emotion. And like you said, it hits it right here, man. It hits it right here in the feel goods and the heart. It pulls on those strings, and that the public does get because they get human. They understand when there's human suffering. I think that's kind of a universal sign of like, oh my gosh, like, and if they really knew how bad EMS and some of these public safety lines are suffering and hurting, you know, I would hopefully think that they would do more to advocate and honor those individuals, because, you know, I've seen the way that paramedics and EMTs are treated by the general public, and it sometimes is very disheartening. But it's not why I got into this. I don't listen to that noise. You know, I got into this to be of service to my fellow human, not necessarily myself. And they are putting themselves out there, and they're putting themselves before, you know, their families, they're putting them before themselves. You know, it's all about the next call. And the reason why a lot of people just don't realize this with the general public, and if you are part of the general public and you are a civilian and you are kind of watching or listening to this episode, you know, the next time you see, you know, a first responder, give them a high five, give them a thank you, give them a handshake, you know, stuff like that goes a tremendously long way in whatever that individual might be dealing with. Because I can tell you, like you said, we invest and they invest oftentimes, like they're paying for their own schooling, they're paying for their own time, and just to work a thankless job. And 7 years, they're burned out, they've been treated like crap, kicked around the corner, and nobody cares. You know, I can tell you a lot of individuals, when they go through some sort of mental health disorder or emergency or a sentinel event, nobody's there for them. And it's just like throwing out the trash sometimes. That's what it kind of feels like. At least that's what it felt like to me. And that's something I do hope we can change. And people like you are doing that, so I applaud you for it.
100%, Chris. And, you know, that's why I created a hashtag, thank medics for their service. I think that kind of, you know, when you say thank you for your service, there's a lot of additional conceptualization that's going on behind that phrase, as far as, you know, like we're talking about honor and value and, you know, things like that. So, you know, thank medics for your service. That's a step one towards what, you know, the everyday person listening to this could do if they see someone out there. But, you know, you raised a good point. I was talking to one of my buddies I served with when I was in the Army. He was a combat vet. And you know, was saying, man, thank you for your service, brother, because, you know, you were over there, you were in the shit, you know, you were on the front lines and this and that. And he goes, man, I want to thank you. He's like, you know, you're a paramedic. Like, yeah, I saw some firefights. It was hairy. You know, there was some gnarly days and stuff like that. But every day that you show up, it's trauma 12 hours a day for your shift every time you show up. He's like, so thank you for what you do. And I was like, wow, that kind of put things into perspective for me because, you know, I hadn't really thought about it in those terms before. But yeah, when you start talking, you know, once you understand the term traumatic exposure and how it relates to, you know, what folks see when they're on the job, it really... you can really start to understand the weight that people feel after doing this job for a certain period of time. And it's amazing that people can stay out there in the field for 20, 30 years and do this stuff. It's just a testament to their resilience. It must be because, you know, we talked about it in our conversation before about therapy and stuff like that. And I'm like the Pied Piper for therapy, man. Like I tell everyone I talk to, especially if they're struggling, like go find a therapist, talk about it, you know, get that stuff out. Cause it's like, the analogy I would use with my EMT students would be like, you know, it's picture having a backpack with, you know, shelves on it. And, you know, that this term compartmentalization comes in where we see something out there in the field, we have to kind of put it in this jar, put a lid on it and put it on the shelf so we can keep going on with the shift or keep going on with the mission or whatever the case may be. And you keep putting the jars and you keep putting it on there and it keeps getting heavier and heavier. And, you know, at some point you got to open the cabinet back up and start taking some of those jars off, opening them up, and getting some of that weight off your shoulders because, you know, what we see is not going to be unseen and it's going to stay with us until the day we die. And it can come back, you know, you smell a barbecue and that can trigger, you know, a memory of a burn victim or, you know, things like that. So I think the more exposure, the more humanization, the more that we're raising awareness about what these folks have to go through, I think the better. And I know we're going to touch on it further, but you mentioned the kind of downward spiral that we're seeing in EMS and how, you know, you can watch it happening. People are getting burnt out, especially because of the the pandemic. And, you know, there was a brief period of appreciation that people were showing towards first responders and, you know, frontline workers and things like that. But as most things, it fizzled out. People get bored with stuff like that, even though the folks were still going day in and day out, walking into folks' homes who were sick and, you know, getting sick themselves and all this other stuff. And
exposing their families with that same sickness. Like that's the risk that I don't think people really took to heart. It's like, oh, but it's your job. And you're right. Like, you know, so a couple of things, like here's my shameless plug for every episode about therapists. If you don't have a therapist right now, I highly, highly, highly encourage you to go and seek one out. For a couple of reasons, and I'm going to go over it. I do this every episode because this is how much I believe in it. The typical wait to get into a therapist right now, if you were to call a therapist, is on average 4 to 8 weeks to get in to see them. So when crisis happens and you're like, hey, I don't know how to deal with this. My world's going down. I'm drinking more. I'm having suicidal ideations, bad thoughts, thoughts of self-harm. It's going to take you 4 to 8 weeks, people. And so by having a therapist ahead of time, you know, A, you've established that relationship because you might go and wait that 4 to 8 weeks just to find out this person doesn't connect with you and you really didn't get the help that you were looking for. And that in itself is defeating. I just want to prepare you for what you're going to run into because it's exactly what I did. I wouldn't tell you anything that I haven't done or ran into myself. So finding a therapist that you can connect with, whether you go see them once a year, once a quarter, once a month, you know, having them available and that you're already on their calendar that you could call and you've formulated that relationship like, hey, I'm having a really bad day. I need to get into your next available. They will move heaven and earth in my experience to get you in. But you have to already have that established because if you don't, it's extremely, extremely hard. And I've dealt with it not only with myself, but with several other providers. The next thing I want to kind of hit on that you just spoke about, you know, Derek, is that backpack analogy. I used the same one. It was actually told to me by a good friend, Zach Hatch, you know, who was very active and still kind of is into the fire service. He's retired, but, you know, he called it like, you know, same thing. You got to compartmentalize, you got to put it in a jar, you got to put it away. And that's what we've been doing. You know, some of us a lot longer than others. So when I look at the 30-year guy, I'm like, how did you make it? Like, how? And they look completely unfazed. So I think everybody's built a little bit differently. As we get into this, you know, we could talk about emotional intelligence and what you had and your, you know, was there any childhood trauma before you got into public safety? And then was that, you know, kind of pushed you towards this calling? But essentially, you know, that backpack does get heavier, and it gets to the point, and I like to be very direct about this. There's two things that are going to happen when that backpack gets too heavy for you. Either A, you're going to finally realize that you need to start opening those jars, and hopefully you got a therapist and, you know, resources to help you through that, or B, you're going to end your life. And I'm just going to be straight up, because that was me. I got to the point where my backpack was so damn heavy, I couldn't pick it up anymore. And the only way out I saw and I felt at the time, because of what I had going on, was to end my life. And then luckily, by higher powers under, you know, higher than me, you know, I'm here talking to you today, Derek. But more importantly, I want to share with our viewers and listeners that those really will be the two options that you have. You know, you will break down your marriage. You will break down yourself. You will harm your family as far as emotionally, verbally, physically, hopefully not. But these things are real. You know, there's statistics back what I'm saying. If you don't believe me, go over to SAMHSA.org. You know, that tells the picture very, very clearly. So being able to start taking some of these things out of your backpack, for those of you who have been in this for a while, I highly encourage it. And one way to do that is by talking to a therapist. So once again, and if you're new, you're a new EMT, a new nurse, a new physician, a new law enforcement officer, corrections dispatcher, I highly encourage you, A, get that therapy and get that therapist kind of lined up. But at the same time, start working on getting the tools to be emotionally resilient and understanding and having that emotional intelligence and self-awareness. So it's my shameless plug for every episode. So with that, we'll kind of move on. But man, you know, there is a lot with that. And I do see, like, when we talk about, you know, the gratitude from the general public, right? I see it every fire season when wildland goes out, man, they're getting their fuels paid for. They're getting, everybody's taking them. There's people lining up on the road. You know, people lined up down the road as I was driving my ambulance by, only the guy that wanted to ride to the hospital. That was it. Nobody was thanking us. Nobody was buying our meals. And yes, during the pandemic, there was a lot more appreciation. But once again, at least from the outside looking in as a paramedic, and I could be biased, and tell me if I'm not, but I'm also a firefighter, so I'll play that card. But I saw a lot of the appreciation go to nurses and physicians and those working in the hospital. And don't get me wrong, like they were grinding it out too, just like all of us, and seeing, you know, the long drawn out effects of COVID. But there still wasn't the same equal amount of honor and respect given to those EMS workers and those dispatchers that are so diligently still working behind the scenes day in and day out. And I honestly, I don't know why. And that's why I love, like, when I see, you know, new projects come out and new awareness and, you know, people talking about it a lot more. Do you have any insights on that? Like, why do you feel like EMS just, you know, and dispatchers and some of us behind the scenes, why do we keep getting shit on? And I hate to say that, but that's what it feels like.
I think, like you were saying, it's just kind of how we came up as kind of the stepchildren. But also, you know, police and fire have worked really hard on their public relations campaigns. I mean, they have put their image out there. They have, you know, all this other stuff. The other thing that, you know, I've been talking to a lot of people about this lately, is just kind of uniformity too. You know, you look at EMS on the Hill Day or whatever, and you have 30 different uniforms up there from 30 different agencies, you know, from 30 different count, you know, there's no cohesiveness. If you showed up as a force with 30 people all wearing the same uniform banging on the desk, like that's a much more intimidating, you know, prospect. So there's a lack of uniformity across the board, and cohesiveness to kind of bring us together. But on like the public relations front, that's kind of where, you know, I'm kind of coming in to try to pump that up and give you that hero shot. But it's also, yeah, it's also a perception too. You know, I was talking to someone and he was mentioning, you know, we're called the third service, when really we should be called the first service when you look at call volume. I mean,
yeah,
in any city that you're going to look at, EMS is going to be hands and shoulders above, you know,
fire and rescue, you know, exactly. Yeah, they're definitely going to be a lot further ahead.
And if you look at the number of just the total number of fire calls that, you know, a department goes to in a given year, it's minuscule. You know, they it's almost like they have to be responding to EMS calls to justify their existence. And so when you look at it from that perspective, it's very confusing as to why, you know, this is the roles are kind of reversed. But hopefully through some of this public awareness, some of these campaigns that we're talking about, that can make the change. But I think a lot of it has to do with perception, and almost thinking about it from a marketing perspective, because, you know, that's like we're saying, you have to, it's hearts and minds that we need to win in this kind of battle. And, you know, like you mentioned it, the pressure from this particular battlefront of the pandemic was higher than ordinary, because, like you were saying, not only are you worried about your own safety, but now I'm worried about getting my wife sick, getting the people who are closest to us sick, people in our pod. Like, you know, there was just kind of ever ballooning weight of uncertainty on top of the normal traumatic exposures and all this type of a thing. And so if people don't see that, if they don't understand that, then, you know, we almost can't blame them for not wanting to help or not for not having that. But Brian E. Gilby, the director of Honorable But Broken, said, you know, once you know, now what? You know, so so that's why we're trying to at least get to that level of awareness. But more than that, you know, when it comes to the crisis, like we're talking about this downward spiral, like people are jumping ship, no one cares about them. You know, they're getting burnt out, they're getting mental health, you know, untreated mental health things. So that's shrinking the workforce, and that's making the people who are doing the job have to work harder, mandatory overtime, longer shifts, less rest in between shifts, things like that. And so
we also do it to ourselves, you know, sometimes. So I want to do that, because you brought it up, like, and obviously now that I have a little bit more of a business sense, I look at it from a marketing perspective. And I think that's the easiest way to look at it. Like, when you look at image, right, you know, if you watch a commercial, and let's say because I know this will polarize people, you got Ford versus Dodge, right? And Ford over here, they got a nice clean truck, they got nice clean commercials, they have this nice kind of family feel. And then you got, let's just say, Dodge, which I own a Dodge, so I'm not, just if it happens, I'm going to shit on them for a minute. But if they have this other over here, and their trucks are dirty when they're doing their photo shoots, or very arrogant, you know, they're disheveled, you know, which one are you as the general public going to typically choose and side with, right? So now change that Ford versus Dodge versus fire versus EMS. You mentioned, you know, uniformity. I think uniformity is a huge thing. There are some, you know, EMS services that require, you know, uniforms, right? And they have a standard. But I've also seen a lot of, you know, EMS companies, you know, mainly on the private side, but you run into this anywhere, especially on the government side. But, you know, they're showing up with their boots untucked and they're not polished, and maybe they got blood on them or mud, and their shirt's untucked and they're overweight and we're not taking care of ourselves. There's a myriad of things, but people, like, public perception is exactly that. I also try to challenge especially the EMS providers. Firefighters can get away with this, like, it's been proven, obviously. But when you talk to, like, you know, because here's the general thing, like, hey, what do you do all day? I just sit in my recliner and play, you know, Call of Duty all day. That's the perception that your friends and family now have of you, and then they go tell other people. So we really need to start being advocates for ourselves. And I do wish that, you know, the National Association of EMTs hopefully we'll continue to rise up to this occasion. I think we got some really good leaders in there right now, with, like, Michael Caduce is on the board, and some changes coming. And I couldn't be more thrilled, right? Because I do hope that they can advance and basically wage a PR war and educate the general public of why it's important. And more importantly, what's going to happen when you dial 911 and nobody shows up, or the person that shows up has been on the job for 30 days. Versus, you know, someone who has been on a job. I wouldn't want the brand new guy coming out of residency. That's why we call June pretty much like kill month, right? Because that's when they're all hitting the hospitals. But, you know, we want that. We have to have a mix of experience. But our workforce is shrinking, guys. And if we don't advocate for ourselves and we don't put out that level of professionalism, you know, you should be proud to be a paramedic. You should be proud to be an EMR. You should be proud to be an EMT. But act like it. Show up with a clean, tucked-in uniform. Be sharp. Get yourself nice, clean, and shaved. I'm not saying you have to go bald, but gosh, you know, I see some of these people that just, if you can't take care of themselves, that public perception affects all of us in this industry, not just you, not just where you're at. You know, you could be dealing with a visitor from New York, and you're, you know, an EMT in San Diego. And if you're showing up and you're kind of sloppy and laissez-faire, and you're, we got to dial it in. We got to start holding people accountable to that standard. And then we got to start advocating for ourselves and really telling people what it is that we do. And I'm not saying show them the blood, guts, and gore. That's not what I do. Hey, I've gone through almost 8 years of schooling to become a critical care paramedic. I have put in thousands upon thousands of hours to understand medicine and be able to deliver that not in a hospital where I have resources, but at your house. So I can immediately start making a difference in your lives, because statistics show that the sooner that we start some of these life-saving interventions, the likelihood of you actually living tomorrow to see your family goes up. So why would you not want that? So we have to advocate for ourselves, I think, as well.
100%. And, you know, that's what you mentioned is what gets me out of bed, up and moving every day, is that thought of calling 911 for my wife if she's experiencing some sort of time-dependent injury or an illness, and, you know, having them say that there's no ambulances available or one's an hour away for mutual aid. Or, yeah, I would lose my mind. I would lose my mind.
And it's happening. It literally is happening right now, folks. If you don't realize it, like, people are getting transported in police cars because the police can't wait 45 minutes to an hour to get an ambulance. And I'm not saying this is happening on some systems. It's fairly consistent just because they're going through staff shortages. And guess what? You know, if we're continuing not advocating for our industry as EMS providers, dispatchers, things like that, and people see the trauma that it's spitting out and that burnout is in 7 years, like, I'm sorry, but why would I want to get into this profession knowing that in 7 years, everything that I've invested is not going to be there? That's just a stupid, dumb business decision at the end of the day. Why would I not want to just go, hey, I'm going to be an electronic engineer or an aircraft mechanic or, you know, something else where I get to go home and be happy every day and have a long, fulfilling career and get paid well? Like, the people that do this, they do it out of love and service. And God bless, I love all of us. But if we don't start taking care of our own, and we don't, you know, work on that avocation and showing that standard and showing up, you know, high, tight, pressed, we're going to continue to lose this battle. And you are going to see EMS continue to shrink, and there's going to be workarounds, right? You're already seeing it as far as, you know, I remember when there was only like, when I got in and became a paramedic in 2003, maybe it was 2004, I think. It's been too much. But when I came in as a medic finally and I got my medic license, like, I worked at a fire department. There was only two medics for the entire shift of five stations. Now, there used to be a medic, like, a couple of years ago, there was a medic on every station, sometimes two. You know, there was a lot. And now we're starting to see it go back to where agencies are now using ALS fly cars and other methods to, hey, but what that does is it puts a strain on down below. So now you're seeing EMTs pick up higher acuity. They got more stress because maybe they weren't clinically confident or trained appropriately. And it just all goes back to education and training. What about some of the stories that you've captured? So I know when you take photographs, you know, by first responders and you capture that, you know, it really does offer like a poignant glimpse into what the realities are of what a frontline first responder works for. You know, I love the A&E series. Gosh, it's going to escape me right now. And you probably already know this, but help me out here. You know, the one that they had where they started out in New Orleans and they basically just had EMS all the time but it really kind of highlighted, you know, they showed CPR being done in the back of the ambulance and, you know, some of the people spitting on them and how they were treated. And, you know, but what did I feel like I wish they would have captured, and, you know, an idea for a future project, really, if your director is watching this, is tell the story of what happens when people go home after seeing that. You know, how is their home life? They're not happy. They're not doing the things that they love. They're not going outdoors. They're not hiking. They're not enjoying the time. They're not present with their family. Like, it literally is a slog and it sucks, you know. But these images that you do and you document, you know, you document the courage and the dedication of these first responders. And it really does convey like a profound emotional toll. And I can't stress that enough, that they see and they go through.
Yeah, each, you know, photos from the front lines is kind of a series of little vignettes, little portholes into this time and place and this experience for these folks. And I try to get the viewer to, you know, kind of, first of all, kind of humanize this crew, get to know them and kind of understand that they're human beings and they're the ones who are kind of experiencing this. And then you can kind of take that turn into, you know, the full scale of, okay, well, here's what they're going to see, here's what they're going to go through and things like that. So, each story was a unique experience. And also for me too, it was a little bit different. And it was still hard. I mean, even after all these years, Chris, and all the stuff I've seen, and you know, all the healing I've done, and the therapy, and this and that, you know, it's still hard to have to see some of this stuff and to witness some of these things.
Hard to go back in the
fire, man. And even though I had that extra layer of separation because I was behind the lens, you know, capturing, I wasn't, you know, involved in the patient care, and you know, the person's life wasn't my responsibility, you know, in these situations. But it really reminded me just how deep this stuff impacts people. You know, there was a case where I didn't even show this in the book. There was we were in Oakland. We're actually supposed to be assigned to Hayward, the next city down, but because it was so busy, we got pulled into the Oakland system, and we ended up running calls up there all day. And we were nearly first on scene for a shooting in Oakland. And you know, when I got there, the you know, police and fire were just, you know, rushing up, so everyone was just kind of getting there at the same time. And you know, we're a little bit behind, so we had to get the stretcher and all that type of gear and stuff. And you know, as we're walking up, you're seeing a blood trail, and it wasn't like, oh, there's a drop and there's a drop. It was like spurt, spurt, spurt. So you know, as medics, we're in our mind, we're calculating
arterial,
you know, blood loss and yeah, and things like that. And we're saying, looking at each other like, not looking good, man. So you know, we finally get to where the patient's located, and fire department's already doing CPR and this and that. And I didn't capture any photos of this event because it, you know, as a photojournalist, you know, I have my own integrity. I didn't feel it was right at that moment to be snapping away. Even though there were very compelling images and, you know, the medics, you know, the emotional turmoil that they were going through trying to save this guy and this and that was very intense. I stood back and, you know, was just an observer of this scene. But you know, what really struck me was to this day, hearing the wife calling out for her husband's name. And I mean, it's still,
wow,
it still gets
chills
me
just saying that, man.
And you know, I was wondering when I was going back out in the field, how I was going to be able to handle all this stuff. Cause you know, I got burnt out and I, you know, still had hadn't really done any trauma processing, you know, hardly at all up to that point and stuff. And so, but you know, that, I think it was that night, you know, whatever, I got home and I was in the shower. My wife was talking to me and, you know, I just remember just the tears just starting to rain down. Just having empathy for that poor woman. Just imagining my wife having to see, you know, see that and go through that if it was me or something like that. And, it was hard. It was painful. It was emotionally, you know, upheaval. But to me, that was a good sign. In my earlier days, it would have just been like, rip, file it away, on to the mm-hmm. next call, everything's fine. Hi, honey, how are you? You know, it's all good. That type of a thing. So,
and 10 years later, you're now dealing with that, you know, versus.
Yeah, I was able to actually allow myself to feel it and process it and go through it, move through it, and then, you know, kind of move into acceptance and on from there. I mean, it's still in there. Like I said, every time I bring it up, it brings me to tears nearly.
Yeah,
but it's really,
people ask me like what was my hardest call, or you know, some of the things that we see, and you know, you get to ask that question a lot. You know, I remember, you know, when I don't always tell people, and I'm not very honest sometimes, and maybe that's to my own detriment, but it's also to protect myself. But a lot of people, as soon as you tell them like, oh yeah, you're a paramedic, you're a flight paramedic, oh, you must have seen some gnarly stuff, like what's
the
gnarliest
thing you've ever seen?
Yeah, and it's a common thing, to the point where, and I love my wife for this, because she protects me. She straight up goes, and she'll tell them like, hey, that is just not a question you ever ask to a first responder or a public safety person. Ooh, because I get the feel goods, right? Because that brings me back to some of the worst calls. And what people don't understand is it's sometimes it's not the actual image that I saw or the gruesome, you know, the body part, whatever, you know, that I'm looking at. It's not that. Just like you mentioned with that wife, some of the things that are the hardest calls are listening to the kids scream for their mom or dad, listening to the family members begging you to save their life. And when you don't, looking them in the face afterwards. Those are the things that crush me and still do to today, as I'm close to tears as I say this, because that's something that you just can't reproduce, right? Like there's no, you know, and I get it. Like when we talk about military and frontline trauma, you know, them seeing their buddies go through that. Yeah. That's a lot, you know, and I don't think the general public really understands that, because if they did, they would stop asking that goddamn question. And I wish they would, because that's not something you ask. You know, hey, tell me about the worst day of your life, like when your wife cheated on you, or, you know, you got pulled over
for my entertainment.
Yeah. For my entertainment. Please. I want to hear this. Like, no, like it's not a question that you ask. But I do think we could be tactful for it and let people know, hey, and that I am getting better. But I had to learn that from my wife, actually, because she was the one protecting me. And I like, oh, man, you said that really well, because I wouldn't have said like that. I would have just been like, yeah, I've seen some shit, or I would have told them, because sometimes I actually do it just to break them, because I'm like, oh, humor me this then. You know, it's like all right, you want to go down really this foxhole with me? Let's go. You know, and I've had some people that I really have opened up to in that regard that were just, you know, I remember this one Uber driver that was taking me to the airport. He's like, oh, where are you going? I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm going to do some training. I'm teaching some, you know, I do critical care training. I travel for that. And he's like, oh, what do you do? I'm like, oh, you know, I'm a flight paramedic by trade. And he's like, oh, yeah, so you're supposed to see some gnarly stuff. And he was just egging it. Like, he just wanted it. He just kept pushing and pushing. And I just wasn't having it, man. And I could have been better about my reaction. I 100% will own that. But I let this guy have it. I let him basically sit in the same shit that I was sitting in. And I was crying, and this guy, he didn't say another goddamn word the entire drive. And you could see it when he got out of his – he was shocked. He was traumatized. I can tell you that. So is that the right way to respond? No, I don't. I highly don't recommend doing that. You know, but we can be tactful about saying just like, hey, you know, those are things that are very confidential to me, and I hold those close, and I'm still struggling with those. And so it's just, you know, and educate them, because once again, it's educating. We got to educate the general public. I just wasn't in the point, or didn't have the emotional intelligence at that point or awareness to do any education of anybody. It was like, oh, you want to jump in? I'm in the hole right now. Here, let me just pull you on down here another couple steps, and you can sit in the shit with me.
I think that's exactly what you were mentioning before about how a lot of the media around EMS is like the lights and sirens and the crazy calls and stuff like that, but the aftermath isn't really exposed.
Nobody, and I think, yeah, there's not a lot of it. It doesn't seem like
it's, you know, and if you, that's all you see too, is like, oh yeah, they're doing rad stuff. They're, you know, saving lives. They got lights and sirens going. They're high fiving. Like, looks like things are going pretty cool. You know, like if you don't see the fact that, if you don't like that mention, like having to deliver a death notification, you know, when the family member is sitting there watching you work on them for 30 minutes inside the house. I mean, that's, how do you communicate that? But, you know, I think if you can show people those moments, I think that's like the hearts and minds stuff. Like, that's where, you know, I think that empathy can come in and increase that sort of respect, because it's difficult, man. I mean, you know, you can, even photos are excellent, but they still don't capture exactly what's happening. And even film is the same kind of way. You can kind of see it, but unless you're experiencing it, it's a totally different thing. So how exactly that's communicated best to the general public, I'm not exactly sure, but that's something I'm working on. I know you're working on it too. And hopefully if we have a lot of smart people all walking in the same direction, we can start to see some larger scale change come through for these folks.
100%, you know, and that's all it is. It's just, you're right. They see the lights and sirens. They see the rescue 911 or the fire country or whatever is glorified at that point in time. What they don't see is, and nobody will, you won't be able to capture this via film or, you know, camera shots, is the true torment and struggle going inside that person's head and in their heart. You know, that's the stuff that you just can't make up. And you won't be able to feel that or take that away unless you've actually walked that line. And so, but you do, you know, when you capture these images, you know, it does show the moments of resilience and humanity amongst adversity for these first responders. And I do think it provides, at least to me as an EMS provider, it provides a sense of hope and inspiration, you know, because while it may not be anything special to, you know, the general public, other than like, wow, look at that, it was pretty gnarly. Like, to me, it's like, I know what I did in that moment, and that brings me fulfillment and fills my cup and reminds me, more importantly, of why I got into this and why I continue to get on the truck every day and try to be of service and make a difference in somebody's life. You know, whether they're in trauma or whether they're in a mental health crisis, you know, or an overdose, like there's many ways I can bring that back into my own profession. I do appreciate what you guys do and how you capture that and tell that story.
Yeah, I heard a good quote recently that good art is a mirror. And I think that's really what I try to do is just is show people how they look, show them what they're doing, and memorialize, canonize, lionize. I mean, trying to aggrandize, like trying to show folks, or at least portray them at the level that they should be. We have professional athletes where they spend, $1 million doing these rad commercials and making them look badass and stuff like that. But who's lionizing these folks? Who's canonizing these folks? So I think we need more of that. I think another thing, like you mentioned too, about capturing this stuff, it's hard to capture these moments, especially the intimate ones at home, things like that. So I think, again, this is long-term, big picture stuff, but things like narrative films are good because I think some of those like war films from back in the day where they show, the pain in the soldier's face after he loses his buddy or, when he gets back home, they're able to show some of those moments because it's not real life, because you're kind of recreating it and you're it's a narrative kind of a thing. I think some of that stuff would actually be helpful because then you can portray those emotional moments and you can write it and you can time it and you can make it look the way that you want to, that's going to have the maximum emotional impact for the folks watching it. And everyone loves to go see movies. And there's been a handful of stuff about EMS providers, but a lot of it's, like bringing out the dead. It's good, but it's kind of comical and, it's dark, but it doesn't really capture the true trauma and horror and things like that. So, it'd be a challenge, but that's, there's a lot of a lot of writers and stuff out there. If you're listening right now, you can take up that cause. It's something I may be working on myself if I have the opportunity. But yeah, I think it goes back to, like I was saying, to media, public perception, all these things still need more work. And we talked about, I think, a little bit, thinking about doing like a poster campaign about presenting some of these things, trying to recruit, trying to retain, trying to, scare the public and really sound the alarm about the EMS crisis that's currently happening. And because, like you're saying, people aren't going to know there's a problem until they call 911. And like we're saying, dispatcher issues, the dispatcher shortage. We called 911 the other day. We were driving home from a friend's house and we saw a big fire on the side of the road, like a homeless encampment or something like that. And we were on hold for 5 minutes before we even got to start talking to somebody. And, my wife holds the
Wow.
phone over at like 5 minutes and is like, still on hold. And I was like, well, hopefully everyone's still breathing while we're waiting on hold here for 5 minutes before we can even get to talk to somebody, to get CPR instructions and things like that. So,
Yeah, it's not just EMS.
everyone's trained right now. Yep.
Dispatchers have a huge shortage right now. And once again, it takes time and energy to train these individuals, and then burnout is a real thing affecting dispatchers. And so they are also actively looking. And if you just happen to be a producer or someone with Netflix or Amazon or anyone, please reach out to Mind the Frontline because we definitely have some good ideas on what we could do and help further this. But just to give it a perspective, and I'll throw it out there because I don't care who takes it on as long as it gets done. But my vision was always to highlight who they were as a person, right? Show them before the shift, happy, what they kind of do, but then follow them around during their shift. Kind of get to really understand like what they're engaged with during that. And then more importantly, this will be the hard part, getting some of these individuals to open up transparently so you can invite them into their home where you could really see day to day, like what really goes on behind the scenes, the impact and toll it does take on their families, because it's not just them that gets affected. It's everyone around them that is close to them, because those are the ones that we tend to hurt the most. And if you were to do that, and really, because that starts showing, we have these things like, I think it was, there was a show on Discovery not too long ago about, how they would go out and do these like intervention, right? So if you did something intervention style, for EMS, you would really start seeing the toll that it's taking and why the shortage is occurring. And it's just one of many factors and facets, but mental health is definitely up there. And until people really start seeing, because I'll tell you, at least for my family, we were very proud. We didn't tell a lot of people, and unless they listen to these podcasts or kind of follow me, they wouldn't know what we were going through. But yeah, me and my wife went through some heavy shit together, and she absorbed a lot of that because I would come home and while I thought I was protecting the family and not bringing it home, God damn it, I was bringing it home and putting it on blast sometimes.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's another story from the book that it became my first book, Behind the Skirmish Line. You know, I was out with the tactical EMS team the night of the major George Floyd protest in downtown Oakland. And it was a similar kind of thing like you're talking about. And, you know, started off capturing, you know, the medics just kind of hanging out. They're having snacks. They're getting their gear up, you know, things like that. And then the sun goes down. And, you know, now all of a sudden there's a big, huge protest happening. There's glass being thrown and, you know, tear gas deployed and all this crazy stuff happening. And, you know, right in the middle of this, you may remember it happening. There was two federal security officers who were shot at the federal courthouse just a few blocks away from where the protest was happening. Apparently, they're using the protest as like a smokescreen or something like that. And so because the tactical team was right there, you know, a lot of them went over on foot. I jumped in with the commander. And, you know, by the time I got there, the first officer who was more critically injured had already been in the first ambulance on their way out to the trauma center. And when I got there, the second officer was being packaged up. You know, he had a tourniquet on his leg. And they loaded him in the second ambulance to go away. And I was able to capture some of those moments. And then it turns out that the first officer who was more critically injured ended up dying on the way to the hospital. And so the medics had to witness that. And when we got to the trauma center, one of the medics, Chris, you could just see on his face, he just had that kind of glossy kind of zombie look on his face. You could see he was, you know, looked like his heart rate was way up and stuff like that. And he must have like splashed some water on his face to kind of start to come down. But he was like, you could see him kind of spinning out. And the TEMS commander, woman named Heidi, short little petite blonde, but, you know, one of the most nicest, compassionate people. And so she's over there and she put her hand on his arm and she's, you know, talking to him and trying to, you know, kind of talk him down and get him off the ledge. And, you know, I saw that happening. And in that moment, I was very torn, you know, because that was a very private moment for Chris. You know, he's there, he's you know, breaking down. He just saw some horrible trauma and this and that. And, you know, I was trying to decide in the moment, you know, should I take a picture of this or should I just let this moment be and, you know, let him have his privacy and this and that. And I opted to take the picture because I felt like that's what needs to be seen. Like that's the aftermath. Like this is what it looks like after the call's over, when this person has to now sit down and process this and let the weight of everything that they just saw now sink in and permeate, you know, indelibly into their psyche. And, you know, I talked to him after the fact when I showed him the photos and this and that, and I was like, you know, what did you feel about me taking this picture in this moment? I was like, it's very private for you. He's like, I was a little put off, I think, but, you know, he agreed that this is the stuff people need to see. Like, these are the moments that, you know, will have that heart and mind impact and show people what it's really like. And that it's not just the lights and sirens. It's when the walls start closing in that the real issues start to crop up for these folks.
Yeah. And that definitely has to be, you know, I wouldn't want to be in your shoes to make that decision. You know, I'm sure that was a struggle and a hard call to take that picture, but it absolutely needs to be shown because I don't think a lot of people realize, like, the thing that we just drop them off at the hospital and like, okay, our job is done. No, like a person died. You know, not only did a person die, like a first responder died, you know, one of my brothers and sisters, you know, and I sometimes we'll own that. Like I had a part in that death, even though it was out of my control, but that's just who we are. You know, we try our best to save a life. And that's why I became a paramedic, is I wanted to save lives, not have them die right in front of me. And sometimes that just happens and they're out of your control, but you still own that anyways. And so, you know, the general public needs to see that. And they understand that that's real. That's trauma that hopefully Chris, you know, was able to continue and get some, hopefully some counseling and work through that. So, because if not, what does that do? Like that moment then is forever solidified in Chris's brain and goes on to become PTSD and then goes on to lead to who knows what. But for me, it was alcoholism. You know, it was self-harm, you know, suicidal ideations. It was not being present, you know, a lot of things, because PTSD is real. It does not go away. It is a vicious monster. And this is what these first responders go through you know, my worst day of my life, you know, was three back-to-back calls of fatalities, and one was an MCI. And I'll tell you, I'll never forget that day. And I did not treat myself. And so I'm paying for it years and years later, because at the time I was like, ah, three new jars in my backpack. And
yeah, and that's
now,
why I think
now I'm paying the price, or so to speak. And
yeah, I think that that's why mental health for first responders needs to be proactive and not reactive. You know, some of the ideas I have is, you know, if you're going to start an ambulance company, then there needs to be a fleet of therapists that are on staff, you know, in order that should be like a requirement almost of opening an ambulance company, is you have these, you know, this core of folks that are proactive looking at, because like you're saying, you don't want to wait 4 or 8 weeks once the crisis time phase hits, because, you know, then it's too late. You know, the car's already off the cliff. And so if we want to be proactive, then we should have something like, you know, every time you come back to a station, there's, you know, a social worker, a therapist there to debrief the crew. It's paid. You know, you have, you know, it's just your half hour after you get back where you sit down, you talk about some of this stuff, you look to some tools, you know, you get some perspective, things like that. So you can kind of immediately offload some of that stuff, so you're not taking it home with you. And then you should have, you know, a therapist who's on staff every day, who can take, you know, walk in or call in appointments for people who want to, you know, do in between their sessions. And then you should have like monthly or, you know, bi-monthly, something like that, mandatory check-ins, therapy sessions with your, you know, your assigned person. And that way, I know some organizations are doing that. There was actually, I did some photos and videos for Campbell Police in the Bay Area, and they actually had an embedded therapist with their team who would, you know, and it's good too, because they get to know each other outside of the therapy environment too. So that can help to make a more, you know, kind of cohesive bond between those folks. And then they're right there when they need them, you know, for those hard calls, and there's already that relationship established and things like that. So I would love to see more stuff like that coming into effect. And I was really shocked that that wasn't happening during the pandemic, because I was seeing it. You know, you could obviously see people getting burnt out faster because of this increased, you know, pressure and stress load that they're under, and like all the factors we were talking about. And it's like, man, these cats are going to burn out. You're going to lose them. So why don't you try to be proactive? You know, it costs a little money up front, but I think the amount of money that these agencies are putting into recruiting and retention and marketing and all these things are trying to attract candidates, whereas if they just spent some of that money into keeping the folks who are already doing the job, who are already highly trained and motivated well enough to continue to do the job, I think that's a more sound investment of resources than trying to spin up, you know, folks to try and get in the job from scratch.
Yeah, it seems like they want to spend more money to just bring more people through the door, and that takes more money, right? And they're just kind of chasing their tails. One of the things I loved about Air Medical, and I'm not saying that they weren't impacted during the pandemic, but I did see this being utilized a lot more amongst the crews, is the fatigue risk management scale, because they have to maintain their CAMS accreditation and adhere by certain standards. Like, there just isn't any way around it. And so Classic Air Medical, which was one of the ones that I worked for towards the end of my career as a flight medic, or at least my last post as a flight medic, not saying that my career is over yet. But, you know, they had a very, you know, I felt like one of the more robust ones, where they looked at, you know, not only your sleep, how much sleep, how many critical calls did you have? Like, did any of those, were they, you know, sentinel, that was there a death? Like, they would look at these things, and then would go off, and there was an OCC kind of operational manager that would look at these things. And sometimes we want to keep on going, and they would call up and be like, no, you're down. Like, you're out. Like, we're putting you on timeout, and you're going to go down for 6 hours or 4 hours or whatever that might look like. And you're going to take care of yourself. You're going to get some sleep. You're going to decompress, and then you're going to go back out there. But we don't have that so much in EMS. And I wish we did, but obviously I understand the barriers of it right now with the shortages and all that. So we wouldn't be able to do that right now. But I do think if we start, like you mentioned, investing in good mental health resources, education, prevention, not reaction, and start moving that direction, it would be really nice. Like, I do know of a couple, one specific EMS training program that they look at their QAQI, you know, for their ride-alongs, their paramedic students that go out on ride-alongs, and they look at that and go, oh, you saw this, or, you know, there was these critical events. And they built that in, and they basically pull them off and go, hey, you don't need to go on that next ride. Like, you're good. You're going to take some time. So they do have someone watching out for them. And if we just spend a little bit of time and energy into that, you know, that's getting a return on your investment. Because one thing in business that we talk about is, what is your customer lifetime value? Well, what's your EMS lifetime value? Well, right now it's hanging around 5 to 7, but what if I can push that to 15? Okay, well, what is that going to take? What's that investment? I can almost assure you it's probably, you know, upfront, yes, probably a little bit more, but long term, not having to cover and pay out your butt for the overtime and all that, that is also forcing your ambulance company to take more shortcuts and potentially go out of business. It's like, you know, at some point you just need to take that risk. And I think, you know, CEOs, chiefs, directors just really need to take that hard look. And, you know, hey, this is what we're doing, Derek. We're preaching it. We're basically telling people, like, hey, this is what you need to consider. And what it does is it arms the frontline first responder with the knowledge, so that way they can hold those above them in leadership capacities accountable. And that's why you're also seeing a shortage of the students right now, because, you know, the age gap is growing, and these people, these new EMTs, these new individuals, these new human, they're more tuned in than I think we were ever when we came into this career. And so they're coming in going, looking at it like, nope, that's a hard pass. And they're just moving on.
Well, I think you raise a good point there too, where, you know, taking care of our own, we need to go back to education as well. I mean, when I was, I was a program director for an EMT program before I moved up here to Oregon. And, you know, by the time I left, probably a third of the program I was personally devoting to teaching resilience skills, yoga, mindful breathing, all these things that, you know, I wish someone taught me when I was coming up through EMT and paramedic school and stuff. And this is above, you know, the 170, whatever the minimum mandated hours are for all the skills and the didactic training and everything like that. Because, you know, I didn't want to be that person sending these folks out there who are, you know, unarmed or unarmored. And I think that's something that needs to be considered by program directors. And, you know, even if we're talking about the national level, like the NAMSI and things like that, as far as policy and things of, okay, yeah, we may mandate that we need 170 hours to train an EMT for all the skills they need, but we're also going to need another 40 to 60 hours on top of your medical curriculum devoted strictly to mental health, resilience, awareness, tools, you know, things like that, because that's another thing, that another investment that could be made very easily and very quickly that could have a big impact on the longevity of medics throughout their careers, in conjunction with some of the things like we're talking about, like therapy, social worker, you know, Mind the Frontline has the call thing, you know, like all these things, if we can bring them all together and get them, you know, again, uniformly distributed throughout the country and making sure that every medic is taken care of. Those are other things that could be kind of more quickly adopted. But again, that's also on us. You know, we can't expect the public to say, you know, we need 40 to 60 hours of mental health resilience training added to first responder stuff. Like, we know it. So that's why we need to be the ones to be sounding this trumpet, I think.
100% agree. I couldn't echo that call for action any louder. If you are a representative of NAMSI or the NAMT, you know, we would love to sit down and have conversations on how we can bring this into initial training, because, and not only initial training, ongoing training, like there needs to be requirement, just like I need to take a PAT every year and maintain my physical assessment. Like, you know, we need to be taking care of our mental health and realize that they go hand in hand. I had a good conversation with a very receptive and what I would say progressive leader at a fire department here locally in Salt Lake at South Jordan. You know, I'm going to give him kudos, because I think kudos needs to go where kudos go. But, you know, Chief Dawson out with South Jordan Fire, he's really trying to take a progressive stance with mental health. You know, he asked me, we had a meeting recently with him and one of his deputy chiefs, Chief Lesner. We talked about mental health, and they asked me kind of what my thought was on some of these things. And after me hearing about what they're doing, then they're like, hey, we're doing quarterly kind of check-ins, mental health assessments, things like that. And, you know, and this is what I told them, and I didn't want to kind of blow out his candle, but I was very blunt. You know, I said, hey, Chief, like, first off, kudos, because there's not a lot of agencies that are doing that. You know, you guys are really trying to find a way to invest in your own employees to prevent them from turnover, from burnout, from leaving the industry altogether. Because once we leave, they don't come back to EMS. Like, that's a rarity. Like, they move on to something else. Like you mentioned, you went on to the trades. So we are losing these resources. But what I said is, Chief, you know, what is your requirement for physical fitness? Like, you provide your employees with a gym membership at the rec center, their family gets a free, you know, gym membership, and, you know, you have physical fitness standards. You expect them to be, you know, doing something physical every day. Yeah. So they have all this stuff, and I'm like, okay, so that's a daily thing. But what you're telling me, and I don't mean to discredit this, but what you're telling me is mental health is a quarterly thing. Now, what if I flip that? What if I said, hey, you only need to work out once a month or once a quarter? You know, no, that wouldn't stand. And on top of that, you know, you can see when someone kind of loses their physical fitness and may fall out the shape. I'm sorry, I just got a little, you know, I've been out for a minute, I'm a little soft. You could tell that. But what you cannot tell is this in good shape? And while a quarterly check-in is definitely a step in the right direction, I still would challenge you to do more. And how is that? You know, allowing your staff to lead from the bottom up, you know, and letting them, giving them the tools and resources, which the administration is doing. So that's awesome. But like, hey, like, instead of like every day, you know, when you come on shift, you're having that shift briefing, things like that, you know, you have your changeover. Well, after that's done, you know, maybe it's, let's talk about a topic like humility or anger or fear, like, and have conversations. Let's have a meditation room. Let's have some yoga. You're seeing some new hire academies like Cal Fire, like they're doing yoga and mindfulness techniques. I believe it's the Portland Police Academy. They're putting their staff through almost, I think, 2 to 4 hours every day through the academy of just resiliency training, like, which is awesome. So you are seeing people that are just taking the lead of this, but what you're not seeing, at least in my perspective, and I don't have all the information, so I'm not knocking anybody here, but I'm not seeing the action from the bodies that can actually put this to foot and start making a hard change. And that's, you know, those are the accrediting. That's, you know, that's the Law Enforcement Officers Association. That's the IFF. That's NAMC. That's NAMT. You know, if they came out, like you said, made this a requirement, not only for continuing education, right? I got to do a lot of continuing education to keep my paramedic, and none of that is around mental health, or at least required to be mental health. You know, initial training, same thing. You know, I get the, I mean, the chapter for like health and well-being is like, I think 2 or 3 pages long, at least it was in my initial EMT. Like, hey, eat well, sleep well. Here's eustress, here's de-stress. Good job. You know,
find some way to diffuse stress.
Yeah,
that's all
exactly.
I remember from the health and wellness chapter.
Yeah, but like, hey, here's some good coping techniques. This is emotional intelligence. Like,
when you get there, like,
exactly. Like, this is what you can expect, you know, and this is what to do when you have a hard day and how to work through it. Like, that should all be built into the curriculum, in my personal opinion. Now, I do think it'll take time, and maybe they are working on that behind the scenes, you know, and I don't, you know, like I said, I'm not privy to everything, but these are ways that we can actually start making some impact, but we got to get buy-in. And, you know, it goes back with, hey, we got educating the general public is the same thing as educating our own accrediting bodies and those that make the decisions and those leaders that sit at the top.
Totally. And you mentioned something when we first spoke about how, you know, everything we've tried up to this point, the suicide rate is still the same among first responders. So yeah, I think it's time to make some big sweeping moves. And, you know, that's how the film, I Don't Know What But Broken, starts off, is talking about an EMT for the FDNY, young kid, you know, just fresh out of training, I think was on the job for 6 months before committing suicide. I mean, granted, you know, the kid jumped into New York City during the outbreak of a global pandemic. And, you know, you hear some of the stories from the folks who were in New York during that time period of having, you know, like you're saying, cardiac arrest after cardiac arrest after cardiac arrest, you know, and that's one shift of one day and 1 month. And
I have a lot of friends that work in New York EMS, and unfortunately I've lost a few. And so trust me, like, unfortunate for that gentleman, and it sucks. I hate to say unfortunate, but I really wish, you know, once again, they would have armed him with a little bit more tools and things to get, you know, hey, what am I going to run into when I get out there? Not wait till it becomes reactive and a problem, because here's the problem, folks. This is a silent and deadly killer. And you're right. Like, it's something I almost say almost every podcast and to a lot of people. We got more smash to stigma, more awareness, more programs, more resiliency training, more SISM. What we do not have is any, well, I almost say any, but we really haven't, in my opinion, when you look at the statistics and the numbers of the suicide rates, touched it. Like, we're not scratching the surface. It's like me trying to stand in front of a freight train and push it back. It just is not working. So, you know, unfortunately, we do need to go back to the drawing board and go, hey, what works and what doesn't work? And are we doing this right? And really have some tough, hard questions and you know, discussions, more importantly. And if you really want to make a change, start with some of this stuff early on. And I would love to see some sweeping motions, you know, some ground shaking, you know, earth shattering, you know, policies and procedures put in place. Because otherwise, I mean, this is just going to continue to drag on. Like, how many more thousands of lives do we need to lose in our own profession while we continue to shrink it and not be able to, you know, effectively do the job? Because what's going to happen is it's going to hit a critical mass where it's just going to snowball and get away from us. Like, right now we are barely holding the line, but it's going to spin and get out of control, and then it's going to collapse. And when it collapses, then everybody's going to be like, I didn't see that coming. Well, guys, I've been telling you for a couple of years now, it's coming. Like, you're saying it, Derek, it's coming. It's here. Like, if you guys don't start doing something drastic about this, you know, hey, California's running out of water. What do? Shut down the overusage of water, shut down lawn control, you know, all this other stuff. We should be doing the same stuff. Okay, well, if we're seeing the collapse, what are we doing? We really need to be throwing more time, more resources, and more money to get these resources out early, have daily, and make this a daily thing. And that's what I kind of try and preach with people about our membership with Mind the Front Line. It's not just a, hey, I'm cool kid, part of the club kind of thing. It's a tool to work on your mental health and wellness every day, because that's what it takes, especially if you've been in this career for 23 years and have not dealt with those jars and you're now starting to open them. But more importantly, if you have some tools like this, whether it's Mind the Front Lines membership or anything else, you got to do this on the daily. It needs to be part of your daily routine, or at least bi-daily. But if you're just like, hey, I'm going to wait till I need it, what'll happen is you're going to get yourself in that fog and that foxhole, and some of them ain't going to come out. And that sucks. I hate losing friends. It sucks. I feel like it's completely unnecessary, and I still don't feel like we're really making any earth-shattering changes. And to really put it out on organizations like Mind the Front Line to try to take the lead on this, it's just, you know, I'm kind of like, is this really where we're at? Like, Cal Fire, Portland Police, like, if they're really taking the lead on this to make a change because they believe in it, but the you know, the leadership and their associations don't really want to kind of dabble their foot in it. Yeah, I know the financial impact that's going to happen by requiring the expansion of hours. I get it, but it needs to happen. Otherwise, guess what? You're just putting Band-Aids on arterial bleeds, folks. It ain't working.
What kills me, too, is that, you know, we say, hey, we need more training, we need more funding, we need more, you know, people on the streets, all this other stuff. And, you know, the question always comes back of how are you going to pay for it? Well, how come that question is never asked when the fire department puts their budget down on the desk, or the police department? Like, they put their budget down, they go, okay, you got it, whatever you need. Top of the line stuff, sure. You know, manpower hours, sure. Training hours, sure. You know, there's never any question. But why is there a question when we put our budget down and says, hey, here's what we need to just to maintain, just to stay from this collapse state that we're seeing coming? And, you know, people are like, well, are you going to pay for it? Well, that shouldn't be the question. The question should be, you know, what can we do to support these folks and keep this system, which everyone needs and everyone's going to depend on at some point in their lives, from going the way of the dodo? And I'm not sure exactly what's going to be the catalyst to make that change. But I think, again, it goes back to the raising awareness, to, you know, to scaring the public and to opening up their pocketbooks, because unfortunately that may be what it takes before people will actually take out. And that's human nature too, on some levels, Chris, right? You don't care about something unless it's personally affecting you. So that's why I think getting these images, things like the film, getting that stuff out there, the more the better, because it needs to reach a critical mass where people no longer question the funding for keeping our medics safe, healthy, and on the streets.
100% agree. And I know you were on the Honorable But Not Broken project. Obviously, you got the poster behind you. How was that? You know, how inspirational was it to be a part of that project?
Amazing. And, you know, the director, Bryony Gilby, she reached out to me. She's seen some of my images from my book out there in the world, and reached out and told me about the project and how she's trying to make a documentary talking about the EMS crisis and, you know, the stress and strain that EMS providers have to go through and whatnot. And I was interested. And I was like, oh, this sounds cool. And then she mentioned that three of her kids are actually EMS providers. And once she said that, I was like, oh, okay, you do understand. Yep. Because if it was just some like auteur filmmaker trying to make a film about EMS, I may have been a little bit more skeptical, but she's seen behind the curtain. And she's hearing front, you know, firsthand from her children what things are like out there in the field. And again, New York City, you know, they got hammered by the pandemic when it first sparked up. And so hearing about that, hearing about the project and this and that, she was asking about featuring some of my images in the film. And so once I heard all that, I said, of course, and was, you know, happy to help her out in any way I could. And then, you know, it kind of turned into a bigger project than I realized initially. You know, she had been doing a lot of advocacy and talking to folks. And there's actually a paramedic who was on the cover of Time magazine named Alana, who's, you know, part of the New York City EMS. And she was mentioning how she was making the film and whatnot. And this paramedic, her uncle just happened to be the longtime sound man for Sarah Jessica Parker. And so I guess he kind of brought the idea of the film and the trailer to her. And once she kind of heard the story about this paramedic and saw a bit about the film and whatnot, she was compelled and offered to narrate for the film. And so she did, you know, sat for a whole narration sequence. And, you know, when I heard that, it really struck a chord in me, because to know that someone who is that, you know, that busy and that famous and that prominent was willing to lend her voice to a project like this, it was powerful. And I think for anyone who was involved in the production or anyone who watches it, you know, and hears someone like that doing the narration, I think that's it was just jaw dropping. And, you know, hopefully it can make this project rise to the level of, you know, national awareness, because we really need to get this film onto a streaming platform and into the homes of every taxpaying American in the country. Because again, that's where we can start having some real impact. You know, it's great to show it to legislatures and people within the EMS community, again, as that kind of mirror of, we see you, we understand, you know, what you go through. We're trying to do what we can to advocate for you, kind of a thing. But, you know, again, really hammering home and getting to the heart of what we need. Because again, people are going to need to open their pocketbooks, you know, when we start telling them what the solutions to these problems are going to be. And, you know, I think if we can prime the pump enough with some of these stories and images, that can be what it takes. So it was an incredible project. We're still working on, you know, trying to promote it and get the word out there. And they're doing screenings across the country and stuff. So it's still kind of, hopefully, on the uprise of really raising awareness in the country. And, you know, hopefully we can use it as a tool to address some of these issues that we've been talking about.
No, I absolutely love it, man. And I have seen it, and it is a very powerful kind of docu-film. And to have someone like Sarah Jessica Parker get behind it, you know, it's compassion. You know, I've reached out to Jeremy Renner myself to see if, you know, hey, can you help me out, brother? Because, you know, he's experienced firsthand from flight medics and what it takes like, and just seeing his resiliency. But you're right. You know, we need to educate and get this film out to mainstream, you know, on YouTube or Hulu, you know, any of the major devices, streaming services. So that way it hits the impact home at the home level, because then it is going to come. There is going to come a time where, guess at some point you're going to need to pay for this, and I'm sorry, someone's going to have to raise the tax. And I know that's what needs to happen, but you're right. It's like, hey, how does the fire department, and they typically seem like they get a lot more. You know, I can tell you that because, you know, I know a local fire department that was trying to advocate to bring community health, and that got shot down. But fire, oh, you want to hire more firefighters? Great, cool, no problem. Community paramedic? Nah. They didn't see the value of that. And so that's not only that, it's like it's educating the people that make those decisions, the city councils, the city managers, things like that. Because honestly, you know, if they saw like a line item for a meditation room come across or yoga mats, they would be like, wait, what? Like, no. But if they knew why, you know, the reason behind that, and obviously, hopefully leadership as they go to their budget proposals and things like that can convey the importance of some of these things, then they understand it, you know. And unfortunately, until it's happened to you or you know someone that it's happened to, you just don't really get it. And it's just not that prevalent, especially when you have things like Ukraine that blow up your TV every day or Donald, you know, the politics, you know. It drowns out what is actually happening to us behind the scenes. And unfortunately, I hate to say this. I really don't. I really, really do hope it doesn't come to this. But I think you're going to see the collapse of a couple EMS systems. And that is when the alarms are going to go off and you really start seeing some of the traction, which I hate it. It's like we train ourselves not to be reactive, but we are reactive in some degree. And sometimes that's out of our control. But when you start getting a community that no longer has an EMS service because they went out of business and there's not really anybody that can come in and take that, and you know they're waiting 5 minutes on 911 on hold, like, holy I've never heard of that, you know, I to me personally. But I have heard of people waiting like 30 minutes just to talk to a 911 dispatcher and get something going. I've heard it take an hour for an ambulance to come over from another county to go to this person. And I do think it's going to affect rural over metropolitan areas a lot harder. And that's where you're going to start seeing the collapse. And then you're going to start seeing air medical. I mean, some of the places that were super, super rural that were going to take a long time, they would launch me in a helicopter and I would land right in your front driveway. You know, because guess what? That's the only person. I really don't need a helicopter. Yeah, I can tell you that. But guess what? Nobody is coming, literally. So it's either this or you AMA and you have someone drive you in, you know, the 3 hours back to where the hospital is. And ultimately they make the decision. And I hate putting someone financially in that kind of predicament, especially in their moment of need. And it's almost like shame on you for putting me in this position is kind of what I say to legislation and Congress. And I really wish they would take more action. But man, I really hope that maybe we can talk after the show and try to work out getting honorable but not broken in a screen here in Salt Lake. I think I got some places we can absolutely help push that initiative. But you know me, I'm all about just, hey, I'm not only going to talk it and smash the stigma, like I'm actually going to do something to hopefully smash the stigma. So I'll break out my sledgehammer and we can get to work. Real quick, let's wrap up. But I want to kind of close out with just, if you could, just summarize some of the lessons that you've kind of learned from the reflections of being behind the camera and the photography and what is brought to you and EMS in general before we kind of wrap up today's episode. Derek, it has been a very, very insightful episode. I've really enjoyed the conversation with you.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, Chris. I think a couple of things that come to mind. One is that I noticed the compassion is still there in a lot of these folks. I think that's really deep down the fire that keeps people in this business for a period of time. And, you know, a lot of the folks, especially, you know, you work in Oakland, you know, you have to have that kind of gruff exterior. You have to have that clinical distance in order to be able to do your job. But my question when I went out there was, is the compassion still down there below? And nearly every circumstance I saw, when the chips were down, when a human being just needed another person to connect with in their time of need, that medic was there to be able to drop that guard and have that human moment and display that compassion. And so to me, that was one of the most beautiful things. Hard to capture on film. You know, it wasn't really like a flashy moment from when I was out there in the field, but that was my experience. And, you know, that in itself gives me hope that, you know, if we can institute some of these countermeasures, that maybe, you know, we can keep these folks in this for the long game. And then they can retire and live happy lives, you know, with their families, kind of a thing. So the compassion was still there. The other thing, like I mentioned, is just it reinforced just how deeply some of these experiences cut with someone, you know, as a witness to trauma. And I think that kind of rekindled in me this desire to want to talk about my own, you know, healing journey and, you know, come on these podcasts and talk about mental health, you know, resilience and awareness and things like that. Because yeah, if you're not in it and if you don't see these things, then you don't know. But I do know, I have seen them and I was out there And, you know, it's kind of like, now that you know what, now what? So that's why, you know, I think the more we can have awareness for this stuff, the more people will want to get involved and try and help out and tell their stories and, you know, snowball this thing into something hopefully good, moving forward. And then, I think probably the last thing that was, you know, interesting to me, you know, is just, the human spirit. You know, a lot of my photography is not focusing on the bloody scene or the car accident. It's focused on the person. And, you know, we're all human beings down below. We all, think and remember and suffer. And, you know, I think the more that we can reinforce that the humanity, the humanization of the folks who do this job, I think the better, because, you know, like I'm saying before, once you understand, you're more likely to want to take care of something and honor it. And, you know, we can't thank our first responders enough for what they do. And, you know, hopefully things like this are a step in the right direction to take care of them and let them know that they're seen and appreciated.
Well spoken. I couldn't have said it better to myself. You know, we appreciate all of you first responders out there that show up every day, whether it be thankful or thankless. At least from our side, we see you and we're trying to do something about it, and just keep hanging in there. You know, the human spirit, I think, is something that continues to amaze me, beyond words, to the point where, you know, I understand why you guys do what you do and you gals do what you do, and keep it up, because nobody else is coming. We're losing more and more people out there. So be resilient, you know, look after your fellow compatriots, your fellow partners and fellow first responders, and be there for them and be safe. All you gotta do is just listen. There's really nothing other than that, you know, checking in, buddy checks, things like that. So Derek, I really appreciate your time today. How can people find your book, Photos from the Frontline?
You can go to my website, dope.net, dohp.net. You can also find it on Amazon. And anyone who orders a copy from my website will be signed by the author.
Oh, love it. Well, that's where I'm going then. I want to get an autographed copy. Well, thank you again for the time, the energy, what you're doing for the community, and sharing our experiences through your first line photography. You know, it's things like this that really do make a difference to not only the general public, but it does help those of us behind the front lines that are working and showing up every day. And it gives us the courage, and it reminds us kind of why we do what we do. And so that for that, I actually do thank you for your advocacy and being a mental health and first responder advocate on that. So as we come to another end and another enlightening episode of Critical Conversations by Behind the Frontline, we would like to express our sincere gratitude to Derek. Like he said, go check out his book, you know, Photos from the Frontline. You can find it on Amazon, but if you get from his website at dope.net, you can also get a signed copy by the author. And, you know, what better way to support Derek and what he's doing than purchasing a copy of his book and reading some of these impactful stories. We are also excited to have Derek on board with Mind the Frontline. He'll be helping us moving forward with our graphic design and our book project and some other things. So we're happy to have him on board and helping us out in our mission through his photography and collaborating with that. So with that, his story truly enhances the mission of promoting mental health and wellness and recovery amongst first responders. Let's all continue to have these critical conversations together and build a stronger, more resilient first responder community. Thank you for being a part of the Critical Conversations by Mind the Frontline. Until next time, be safe, be kind, and mind the frontline. To our dedicated listeners, thank you again for joining us on this critical journey. Remember, the Critical Conversations podcast is a steadfast resource for police, fire, EMS, allied healthcare workers, dispatchers, air medical, and military personnel, along with their families. Your support makes the impact of these conversations resonate even further. If you found today's discussion enlightening and want to stay connected with our ongoing mission, please be sure to subscribe to the Critical Conversations podcast. You can find us via Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the Mind the Frontline website. Your subscription ensures that you will never miss an episode, and it's a powerful way to show your commitment to fostering resilience within the entire first responder community. For more information and additional resources, visit our website at www.mindthefrontline.org. Together, let's continue these critical conversations and build a stronger, more resilient first responder family. We thank you for being a part of the Critical Conversations podcast. Until next time, take care, stay strong, and mind the frontline.